The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The prologue. It's probably difficult to exaggerate the importance of chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. Not only in view of the theological significance of the passage, and I think the amount of literature that has been written about this does reflect the depth and the implications arising from it, but also important because of the very large number of problems that surround its interpretation. And these problems are really multifaceted. They range from questions of detail, for example, textual problems, as in verse 18, is it God or the Son? Lexical problems, such as the meaning of catalambano, is it to understand or to overtake or whatever? Or syntactical problems, as in verse 9, we're going to be looking at that later. So there are questions of details, plenty of them, but also broader exegetical questions, and even some matters that involve the thrust of the passage as a whole. Questions of authenticity: was this really written by whoever the author was supposed to be? What is the relationship between the prologue and the rest of the book? Maybe there is very little relationship, some people argue. What about the significance of logos there? And again, how does that connect with the rest of the book? The background, do we have a Hellenistic background here, a Jewish background? Is there some kind of polemic against Gnosticism? And most obviously, the whole question of Christology. What is the Christology behind this passage, and how does it relate not just to the rest of the book, but to the rest of the New Testament? Well, that's just a sample. I mean, it would be fairly easy to devote the whole semester to the prologue, and I'm really not exaggerating. And I think, the students wouldn't get bored, nor would they feel they were wasting their time. So we're going to be, you know, fairly selective and what have you. But let me just say something of an introductory character, still of introductory character, before we move on to other things. The view that the prologue consists of some church hymn that includes some kinds of Johannine interpolations, that view has become almost staple fare in modern criticism. In other words, I think a majority of Johannine scholars believe that the prologue served as a hymn over a period of time, and served as a hymn generally, but then it was taken over by the Johannine community, and it was somewhat altered to give expression to the distinctives of that community. We don't have to be overly defensive about that, because the theory can actually be formulated in a variety of ways, some of them more radical than others. Sometimes, and I guess often, the theory is stated in such a way that it attacks the integrity of the passage, But there are alternate ideas about this whole thing that are available there. Might this passage, for instance, in some form, have been a hymn in the Johannine community? I mean, that question by itself is not necessarily an intimidating question or one that would undermine anything in particular about the authority of the passage or the gospel as a whole. Could then we relate the hymn to the rest of the gospel by asking this question, is it possible that the gospel was written as a justification of the message of that hymn? I think that's pushing it myself, but I hope you can appreciate that that kind of question too can be answered in a way that, far from undermining the character or the integrity of the gospel, may throw some light on the way in which we ought to relate the prologue to the subsequent material. And there are a variety of other ways of formulating this problem that just thinking about it sometimes helps you look at the material in a different way, so that even if you reject the theory, you are still able to see some things in a different way, and in a helpful way. At any rate, whatever the origins of the prologue, which is a diachronic question, you know, so frequently questions of that sort are simply unanswerable, whatever the origins of the prologue, it is foolhardy, I think, to deny that the passage makes a very natural and beautiful introduction to the book as a whole. And surely our primary task is to expound the text as it stands. I mean, this is the way it has come to us, and to be even more specific about it, there is no real evidence, such as manuscripts or early statements from the fathers or whatever, there's just no evidence that the prologue ever existed separately. So even if it did, or even if we had evidence that it did, the point is that it has come to us attached to the gospel. And the connections are so natural, and I think we will see how closely intertwined the ideas are, that it simply stretches credulity to think that this is somewhat accidental. You know, somebody writes a gospel, and now, oh, look at this hymn. Let's just attach it at the beginning, you know, just to make it sound better or something. It's not going to work. There is a real connection between the two. And I think we'll see that a careful exposition of the passage is its own best confirmation that the gospel must be treated as a coherent whole. Well, so much for preliminary remarks. First of all, let's talk about structure now. Structure. There is a great deal of debate, to put it mildly, regarding the most appropriate way of identifying the structural argument of the prologue. But I think it's important for us to appreciate that the questions surrounding that debate are very closely tied to theories regarding, for example, the original form of the gospel over against the form in which we find it here in the gospel. So that when you find scholars arguing back and forth about the proper structuring of the passage, you find one scholar omitting lines so that it will fit a particular structure. Of course, that's, you know, commonly done all over the place. Or another scholar may posit an Aramaic source so that if you retrovert back to Aramaic, then you can see a certain structure that you wouldn't see it in the Greek, and so on. I'm not saying that all those ideas and suggestions are of no value, but you can begin to appreciate why there is so much debate about them. You're really debating about the structure of a document you haven't seen. And this lack of consensus may be considered the strongest argument against the usual approach. Barrett has some things to say along those lines. However, all right, let's admit that you cannot prove a clear poetic structure for this passage. That is not to say that we should deny the unmistakable poetic quality that we find here. There's rhythm, there is a deliberate repetition of terms, just a general style. The least you have to say is that this is high prose and that it is meant to be, you know, deliberately beautiful. All right, so let's look at the passage, try to come up with some sort of understanding of its basic outline or how it's put together without necessarily trying to come up with a watertight poetic dimension here. And if you make an attempt at a simple outline, you're very likely to detect a fourfold division. Verses 1 through 5 speak of the eternal and creative word. The eternal and creative word, verses 1 to 5. Verses 6 to 8, the testimony of John, John the Baptist, that is. By the way, those verses 6 through 8 are, in particular, are thought by many to be an interpolation at some stage. In other words, there are a number of scholars who believe if you take out verses 6 through 8, it's much easier to come up with a poetic structure. It is also easier to understand the conceptual flow of the argument, and so on and so forth. But in any case, that will be the second section, verses 6 through 8, the testimony of John. Third, verses 9 through 13, with the theme, the light of the world. And finally, verses 14 to 18, the glory of the incarnate word, the glory of the incarnate word. What I'm saying is that almost everyone looking at the passage is going to recognize that those are natural breaks within the prologue. Among features, literary features that you could view as poetic-like, one that is fairly obvious and important, I think, is what some people called climactic parallelism or staircase parallelism. And you see an example, a very simple example of this in verse 1. In the beginning was a logos. Okay. Then, and the logos was with God, and God was the Word. There's a formal symmetry here in verse 1 that is picked up, and actually it's even more remarkable when you look at verses 4 and 5. where you have clause ending with Zoe. The next one begins with Zoe and ends with Phos. The next one begins with Phos, ends with Skotia. The next one begins with Skotia and ends with Auta. Staircase parallelism, or climactic parallelism, whatever you want to call it. What to do with it? In other words, asking the question, just what implications does this have for the exegesis of the passage is another question. And maybe you may not find any. I mean, maybe this is just a feature that adds to this more or less poetic quality of the passage. But it may also suggest, give some indication about other questions that arise that I'm not saying will be answered simply by looking at the way it is structured, but the way it is structured may be suggestive as to the more likely avenues of being able to answer those interpretive issues. With regard to more detailed outlines, and again, this is the sort of thing that has become very prominent in articles on the prologue, lots of literary discussions, each one coming up with its own outline. Perhaps the most persuasive, perhaps, is by a German scholar named Michael Theobald. Theobald, in the beginning was the Word, whatever. This is a whole monograph devoted to the prologue of John, appeared in 1983. And his resulting outline suggests a quasi-chiastic structure. Now, I say quasi because even though there does seem to be a chiasm, it is broken by Theobald's twofold classification, organization rather, his twofold organization of the prologue. He sees prologue divided into two major sections. Verses 1 through 13 is one, and then 14 and following is the other, because it takes on this we style. We style, W-E, that is, we style. Now, at this point, I was going to surprise you and have an overhead. Because I don't want anybody to say that I don't use visual aids. And 20 minutes ago, I went to pull it out. Of course, you think I'm kidding now, but I'm serious. And I couldn't find my folder. And I'm desperately, I mean, this is what you get trying to organize your office, desperately my office, running around. They're going to think I don't believe in visual aids. And I called home, and sure enough, you see, I had taken your papers, those of you who have written papers, taking them home to read them while I'm watching baseball games or something. And I had forgotten just to take the papers out. I had taken the whole folder. I mean, everything is there. So I don't have an overhead. I'm sorry. Nevertheless, and this will be a little difficult now to follow this because I don't even have the original here. And I won't be able to spend quite as much time, but let me give you the basic structure of how Theobald. Oh, by the way, in the fall of last year, the Westminster Journal carried an article by van der Vaart. He's in Europe. You're supposed to read that, or at least I suggested you might read it. It's in your syllabus. On the prologue, and he devotes a couple of pages to Theobald's outline, and he reproduces a couple of the charts. So if you're interested, you can go back to van der Vaart's article and see how this worked out, and also see his own criticism of Theobald's, although he's fairly sympathetic, but he has other ideas that he tries to develop. But in any case, let me see if I can reconstruct now the way this is going to look. He has these two major sections, and well, let me just write it out, and then I'll try to show you how it all ties together. Now that looks pretty complex for a chiastic arrangement. You know, usually it's a nicely, you know, the whole thing goes like this. Now, it might look a little suspicious, but when I show you a couple of these correspondences, you'll see that it's not just being silly here. It's just that he's trying to combine some fairly clear correspondences that suggest some kind of chiastic structure, to combine that with his conviction that you have this twofold organization in the prologue. Now, A must be verse 1, and A prime is verse 18. And the parallelism between these two, I mean, it's indisputable. It really does look like some form of inclusio. You have theos, both in verse 1 and verse 18. Verse 1, ein proston theon, he was with God, surely corresponds with on eston kalpon tu patras, he was in the bosom of the Father. And then the logos idea of verse 1 would correspond to the verb exegeomai, to tell forth, in verse 18. And I don't think anyone is going to be too upset with that. I mean, it really does look like a fairly significant correspondence between 1 and 18. Now, the correspondence is between B and B prime. Let me... B would have to... let's see here. B would be verses 3 to 5. Verses 3 to 5. B prime, where is it? Would be verses 10. It must be 9 through 13. 9 through 13. And the correspondences here would be, for instance, on B you have panta diau tu egeneta, all things were made by him, corresponding in B prime to ha kosmos diau tu egeneta, the world was made by him. Obviously, that's there. You have phos on both of them. You have the verb phine in B and photitze in B prime. Phine and photitze. You have zoe. Now this one is a little, maybe this is pushing it, but you have zoe in B and the verb genau in B prime. That's verse 13. And finally, in B you have his kotia uta ukatelben, the darkness did not whatever overtake him or understand him. And then in B prime you have ha kosmos autan ukekno, the world did not know him. And by the way, that's often when you have discussions about the meaning of the word katalambano there in verse 5, whether or not it has a cognitive meaning or some sort of overpowering kind of idea. If you look at these correspondences, you're certainly going to go with the cognitive, because here you have this parallelism between Catalambano in verse 5 and Ginosco in verse 10 in the same kind of construction. The world did not, either the darkness or the world did not know him or understand him. So that's a correspondence between B and B prime. Between C and C prime, what in the world? C would have to be 6 through 8, right? Oh, wait a second here. I forget now how he divides C and C prime, because I believe that verses 6 through 8 contain both of those. Is that correct? No? No. Okay, now I have it. I remember now. C would be verses 6 through 8. And then C prime would be verses, I guess just verse 15. They both of them speak of John the Baptist. Then, as you can figure, D would be verse 14, and D prime is verse 16. The correspondence between D and D prime, well, first of all, you have the phrase charis kai aletheia, grace and truth. You have those ideas repeated. In verse 14, you have pleires. In verse 16, you have pleroma. And you have this first person idea, etheasametha. We beheld in verse 14, elabomen in verse 16. And when you look at all these correspondences, you know that something is going on here. Now, I certainly don't believe, and I hope Theobald does not believe, that when John or whoever wrote this, he had this map, you know, in front of him or something. This is just Theobald's way of pointing out that you have certain kinds of parallelisms that look chiastic in some respects, but can be helpful in getting a sense of where the argument is moving, and you can allow one section to be illumined by its corresponding section elsewhere in the prologue. At any case, without having to commit ourselves as to how much of this was a conscious literary effort, appreciating the correspondences can be helpful, both in getting a sense for the character of the passage, and maybe even helping us to take certain lines with regard to interpretation. Well, let me pause here. Any questions about the structure of the prologue? Oh, I don't know. I don't have it here. I'm sorry. Must be that verse 2 is included here, and then verse 17 is included in D prime. It's just that I cannot count. 16, 18, what's the difference? But let's see, verse 2. No, probably verse 2 goes with A, I would guess. Any other questions? Yeah. The frustrating thing about this is that you can take any of at least half a dozen proposed structural representations of the passage, all of which look convincing, at least to some degree. And I suppose part of the lesson that we ought to draw from it is something is going on here, but exactly what it is, it may be impossible to determine, and therefore are probably not so important to be able to nail it. If you're really interested, I would suggest you do look carefully at van der Vaart's article, because he does survey, he does talk about Culpeper a little bit. I can't recall offhand just what he says about that. But he pretty much gives you a summary of the more predominant suggestions about this. And he ends up trying to come up with an outline that that takes seriously the redemptive historical movement being represented in the argument. And again, I don't think it's a definitive thing, but it is helpful in appreciating the thrust of how the passage moves. All right, let's move out of this structural business and move on to the second section. Textual and exegetical details. Textual and exegetical details. And what I'm doing here is being very selective in picking three or four items that at least are representative of the kinds of problems that arise in dealing with the exegesis of the prologue. And I think they're interesting in themselves, and they will also help us to get us thinking about some of the broader theological issues that we'll talk about later. First of all, verses 3 and 4, because the problem that I'm addressing here is the proper way of construing those last two words in verse 3, hagegonen. Now, if you have the UBS or Nestle Aland text, you will notice that there's a period before hagegonen and no punctuation afterwards. So the committee understood hagegonen to be the beginning of a new sentence, so that those words ought to be construed with what follows in verse 4. Now, they also give you some notations about different ways of punctuating the material. If you look at Bruce Metzger's textual commentary, you'll see a concise but useful, I think it's very helpful, brief summary of the problems. Metzger dissented from the committee as a whole. So first he gives you the reasons why the committee went with this punctuation. Then in brackets he gives you the minority report, which is Metzger's own viewpoint on this matter. But let me point out first of all that this, strictly speaking, this is not a text critical issue. And it is misleading, to my mind, it is misleading to include this item in a textual commentary. It is even misleading to have, as the Nestle Aland text gives you, manuscript evidence, because everybody knows that when John or whoever wrote this to begin with, there were no punctuation marks here. So you're not discussing whether you put the stop before or after hagegonen is a matter of interpretation, not a matter of restoring the original text. And indeed, the earliest manuscripts available to us, Papyrus 66, for example, or the original Hand of Sinaiticus and so on, there's no punctuation at all. So when you look at the other manuscripts, later manuscripts, or correctors of Sinaiticus, whatever, all you're looking at is how scribes interpreted the passage. That's all. But with that caveat, what would be the reason for putting the stop before hagegonen? Well, just so that we know what we're doing here, let's translate here. Verse 3, all things were made by him, and without him was made udehen, not even one thing. Now, if you don't put a stop there, you would say, was not made, not even one thing of that which was made. And then verse 4 would begin, in him was life, etc., etc. But according to the punctuation that you have in your text, you stop with, not even one thing was made. And then you have this new sentence, what was made was life in him. Whatever that means. And that's the biggest problem. There does not seem to be a lot of sense being conveyed, you know, a lot of information. All that was made was life in him. It's a very strange statement. However, the punctuation you have here reflects the consistent interpretation of the earliest fathers. And I find it particularly impressive when you think of the Greek writers. I mean, if people like Origen and some other Greek writers in the second century understood Hagegonon to begin a sentence, that's a very, very important piece of evidence. A native Greek writer, speaker, this is the way that he's understanding it for whatever reason. That's the other problem. We're not always sure what's motivating the interpretation here. But it is an important point in favor of this punctuation. Moreover, there is something to be said, I think, for the emphatic position of udehen. There really is something stylistically strong, to my mind, with this kai horisau tu egeta udehen, whereas adding the hagegonen kind of slows the style somewhat. There's still another argument which I find less impressive, and that is that if you stop with udehen, it preserves some of this staircase parallelism, but that I think is a little weak here. On the other side, in favor of putting the full stop after hagegonen, so at the end of the verse, is first of all the fact that beginning a sentence with in plus a pronoun, see here verse 4 begins in auto, that is pretty characteristic of John's style. So you could argue on the basis of what is typical of John's writing in this gospel, and also in 1 John, by the way, that it makes sense to begin a new sentence with the preposition, in auto. Another argument, and the one that I think finally swings me over to Metzger's position, is what Metzger calls, in a footnote, the intolerably clumsy and opaque nature of the statement, if in fact the statement begins with hagegonen. Again, this idea, that which was made was life in him. I mean, you can look at the commentaries and see the efforts that people have made to give that some meaning. If they convince you, fine. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that means, and also how it links up with anything else in the gospel. But, you know, what can I say? Incidentally, I meant to mention this before. Theobald, this fellow with the structure, prefers the punctuation that you have in your text here. And the reason he gives is the principle that you ought to prefer the more difficult reading. Now, this is where people get very confused about these things. They see that this is in your textual apparatus, so it sounds like a textual variant, And you remember textual criticism, oh yeah, the more difficult reading is usually the better. But this is not a textual variant. This is an interpretive issue. And what he really is saying, without realizing it, let's choose the more difficult interpretation, which is total nonsense. You know, you don't choose bad interpretations. You choose interpretations that make sense. Anyway. He didn't have much sleep the night before he wrote that or something. I don't know. Any questions about this little... It's kind of like a syntactical problem of sorts. And the second item that I want to mention has to do with verse 9. Again, a matter of syntax. This one is very interesting and also very difficult to come up with a decision that you really feel, you know, sure about. Verse 9, Ein taphos to alethinon ha phothitze pantanthropon erchamenon eiston kosmon. They are basically, actually there are several ways of taking this, but basically two major ways of construing the syntax. The first possibility is that the subject of the verb ein at the very beginning here, the subject of ein, is Jesus. And you would translate he was, and then taphos would be your predicate. He was the light, that is the true light. If you take it that way, then clearly, when you move over toward the last clause, erchomenon must modify the word anthropon preceding it. So the resulting translation would be, he was the true light which lightens up every man coming into the world. Every man who is coming into the world, that is everyone who is born, presumably. So erchomenon modifies anthropon. Problem with that is that the subject is very ambiguous. You know, if he has just been talking about John the Baptist, he was not the light and so on and so forth. And interestingly enough, there are a number of scholars who have argued, not too many, but some have argued that this is actually, verse 9 is a reference to John the Baptist. I heard, what's his name? Oh my. Anyway, rather well-known French scholar, SBL meeting, arguing this point very strongly. And this is an interpolation or some kind of interpretation as well. A John the Baptist group, you see, had composed this. And John the Baptist was the true light. Well, I mentioned that simply to point out that grammatically there's a certain ambiguity in beginning the sentence with ein, and you're not too sure if it is indeed, if there's a subject, you know, to be linked there, what is the subject? That's the problem. Moreover, another question that has been raised against this general way of looking at the verse is that the participle erchomenon, or rather the whole concept coming into the world, more naturally sounds like a reference to the incarnation. It doesn't seem like the most obvious way of talking about people being born. You know, coming into the world, doesn't that seem to be a reference to Jesus? And so, here's the alternate way of taking the grammar or the syntax. The subject, according to this second view, the subject is taphos. And if you take phos, taphos, as the subject of the verb ein, then what you really have is a periphrastic construction. Ein has to be construed with erchomenon. All right, in spite of, even though they're far apart. And the resulting meaning would be, the true light, which lightens up every man, was coming into the world. And so you're anticipating the what's going to be said about the incarnation more explicitly in verse 14. The true light that lightens every man was coming into the world. Now, there is actually a third possibility here, and that is to take the verb ein not as a copula, but rather as a verb of existence, as a verb of existence. And if you handle it that way, the meaning would be, okay, John, you go back to verse 8, John was not the light, but the true light did indeed exist, and that light came into the world. I think that, I don't remember now for sure, but I think Raymond Brown takes that interpretation, and I think he calls it a loose paraphrastic construction or something. I've forgotten now. But it is an alternate way of dealing with the syntax here. Again, my recollection is that Van der Vaart also supports that not the third, but the second one, taking it as a paraphrastic construction, so that it is an anticipatory comment about the incarnation. And the advantage of that, of course, is that you get a better sense for the way in which the argument of the prologue is being constructed here. And it's kind of a beautiful way of putting it. Again, it's difficult to be sure, you know, what's going on here. And I think part of what we're dealing with is that precisely because of the poetic-like quality of the passage, you have a little bit of extra ambiguity. I mean, that's, you know, in poetry that often happens, sometimes deliberately. And I don't think this one would be a deliberate one, but it may be just a function of the stylized or high prose character of the language here. Any questions on verse 9? In other words, with the third interpretation, phos would be the subject, the true light existed, that is, the true light which lightens every man, and that light was coming into the world, or came into the world. Yeah, well, that's what I meant when I said that this could be viewed as a loose paraphrastic construction. I think that's the way that Raymond Brown tries to handle the syntax, but I think your question is a valid one, that if you take ein, strictly speaking, as a verb of existence, and not either as a copula or as some way related to erchomenon more directly, then why don't you have a conjunction with a finite verb in that last clause? I think that's a reasonable objection. Third item is verse 18. This is a text-critical problem, rather well-known issue. No one has seen God, no one has ever seen God. And then you have monogenes theos, the only begotten God. If you translate monogenes literally, it's only begotten, but as you probably know, there is plenty of evidence showing that monogenes can have simply the meaning of unique or only, without the idea of begotten necessarily being preserved in that construction. But instead of theos, which is the reading of some important manuscripts, such as Papyrus 66, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and a number of fathers, etc., there are a number of other witnesses, like Papyrus 75, Alexandrinus, first corrector of Sinaiticus, etc., that instead of theos have here huios. Not Papyrus 75, by the way, that's something else. But huios instead of theos, particularly in Alexandrinus, and then carries over into the majority text. So it's the issue of the only God that was in the bosom of the Father revealed him, or the only Son, or only begotten Son, who was in the bosom of the Father revealed him. It's ironic, by the way, that Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, which some supporters of the Textus Receptus accused of being heretical and disregarding the deity of Jesus, and one of the reasons for that is that in 1 Timothy 3:16, where you have that little poem, the Textus Receptus has theos, but Sinaiticus and Vaticanus have hos, and it's very obvious how this happened. You know, if you have in the this would be the difference in uncials. You'd have the abbreviation for God and then the relative pronoun. Now, Alexandrinus here had theos. Sinaiticus and Vaticanus have hos in Timothy. And so people use that as an example of you cannot trust Sinaiticus and Vaticanus because they don't believe in the deity of Christ or something. Here, you have exactly the reverse situation. Sinaiticus and Vaticanus have theos, whereas Alexandrinus has hos. And of course, the Textus Receptus person will probably say, but you see, is that they didn't have the theological sagacity to realize that by having theos here, you actually confuse the persons of the Trinity or whatever. But anyway, surely the principle of the more difficult reading does apply here. If you have theos to begin with, a scribe is very likely to be affected by two problems. One, linking monogenes with theos, especially if you're thinking of genao as part of the root of the word monogenes. And secondly, you have patros later in the clause, and so you're going to be tempted to have this contrast more explicitly. Huios over against patros. Whereas if you had huios here to begin with, it is very difficult to come up with a good reason why anybody would have inserted theos here. It is not at all common. It may happen, but it's not at all common for scribes to stick theos, you know, just for the point of proving the deity of Jesus or something like that. Besides, that wasn't a problem. I mean, the Arians were happy to call Jesus theos, just as long as you understood what they meant by that. So it makes a lot more sense in terms of understanding the transcriptional evidence to assume that theos was here to begin with, and so it is the original text. And then there was a manuscript variation with huios. And sure enough, the UBS committee has accepted that as the proper reading here. Any questions about that problem?